Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Adam Glick.
And I'm Craig Box.
So I made an interesting observation this week.
Oh, really?
My wife had gone to Starbucks and gotten herself a coffee, and she came home, and I looked at the cup, and then I looked at what I was feeding my daughter, and realized that a Starbucks cup, and really any of the disposable coffee cups that you see, is really just a sippy cup for adults.
Interesting. I would say that the main criteria for a sippy cup, at least in the child-toddler situation, is that you can tip the cup upside down, and the liquid doesn't fall out of it. Is that true of a Starbucks cup?
You know, I haven't tried. I'm a bad person to ask on that. I assume that there is some amount of force you could apply and you could cause the lid to come off, but they are meant that if you tip it over, it doesn't all go.
Shake it wildly. Like, imagine your daughter taking it and banging it up and down on the table or something, saying, I can get the liquid out. This is a science experiment.
It does make me wonder, what are the other things that you look at and you're like, hey, I thought that was a kid's thing, or I thought that was an adult's thing. And the reality is it's the same product and people just have found a new market and a new group of people to use it for.
I have seen a number of takeaway coffee cups and things in the past, back in the day, of course, when we could go and do such things, but some of them had a little flap that you could actually close. So you could get your hot drink, open the flap, close it again. So I reckon if you were to turn that one upside down and not bang it on the table with great force, it probably would meet the requirements for being the proverbial Tommy Tippy cup.
Perhaps we should start up a GitHub page with the child version, the adult version. You know, your kids have a high chair and we have bar stools.
Oh, the things you do when you become a parent.
Shall we get to the news?
Let's get to the news.
Version 3.6 of the Lens Kubernetes IDE has been launched, the first release since Mirantis took control of the project. This release changes to using kubeconfig files for access, as well as improving terminal configuration options and integration with OpenID providers. Additional bug fixes and underlying changes are also a part of the release.
AWS has introduced security groups for Kubernetes pods on EKS. This gives users the same kind of controls they had with firewall-like security group functionality on EC2 instances at the pod level, implemented in their CNI plugin. The update is available for new clusters and is promised to roll out to existing clusters in the future.
The CNCF end-user community has released its second technology radar, this time on observability. The radar works something like a maturity model and breaks various projects and vendors into the categories of assess, trial, and adopt. Congratulations to Datadog, Elastic, Grafana, OpenMetrics, and Prometheus for landing in the adopt category.
The Crédit Agricole platform group has launched Coterie with a K, an operator to manage quotas with confidence. Coterie brings a layer of verification and policy to the native resource quotas mechanism. Instead of your scheduling failing because there are no resources to provide it, your claim object will be updated to tell you why it couldn't be fulfilled, either due to a lack of resources or violating a policy that was set.
Another new project this week is OnePanel, a Kubernetes-native deep learning platform for computer vision. It builds on CVAT, the computer vision annotation tool, and provides fully integrated components for model building, semi-automated labeling, data processing, and model training pipelines.
Edith Levine of Solo.io, our guest on episode 55, has announced that they are creating a specification for WebAssembly, or WASM, modules to be packaged in an OCI image. The images will contain two layers, one for the module and one for the metadata. The first use case for these images will be the Envoy support built by the Istio team, but the spec is general enough for other uses. It currently has the advanced version number of 0.0.0, but is being worked on in line with the upcoming Istio 1.8 release.
Red Hat announced the Red Hat Marketplace operated by IBM, an app store for OpenShift that can deploy to clusters regardless of if they are running on-prem or in the cloud. For an additional fee, Red Hat Marketplace Select is also available. The Select version of Marketplace provides control for an organization to limit which software is available to be installed from users within their company.
Kubernetes security vendor StackRox has announced a $26.5 million financing round to expand internationally and continue investing in R&D. StackRox says its business grew by 240% in the first half of this year, citing companies accelerating their digital transformation initiatives in response to the COVID pandemic.
At their .next event last week, Nutanix announced the Carbon Platform Services with a K, a PaaS that can deploy on-prem, in the cloud, or at the edge. The platform brings a managed Kubernetes and PaaS with serverless functionality, along with a host of features like ingress, service mesh, observability, security, AI, and a message bus.
Kubernetes 1.18 has hit Google's GKE, and with it, the beta of using confidential VMs as GKE nodes. Confidential GKE nodes use the AMD EPYC hardware encryption to enable processing data while encrypted, keeping the keys in the node hardware, with Google having no access to those keys. You can learn more about it in a linked video by none less than Vint Cerf, father of the internet.
Are you curious about running serverless applications on Kubernetes? If so, the CNCF has a new course on the edX platform for you, aptly named Introduction to Serverless on Kubernetes. The course is a free intro on how to build serverless functions and run them on Kubernetes. The course targets doers in IT and development and assumes a basic set of cloud-native principles knowledge, as well as some understanding of the Python programming language. It's written by Alex Ellis, our guest on episode 116, so no prizes for guessing which serverless platform it will teach you.
Finally, the discipline of SRE is often described as changing the engine while the plane is in flight, and JetStack had to do just that. A customer wanted to change the CNI plugin used by their Kubernetes cluster, and customer reliability engineer Josh Van Leeuwen wrote up how JetStack achieved this. Copious examples and a full set of scripts are provided.
And that's the news. Ed Hong is the co-founder and CTO of PingCap, the creators of TiDB and TiKV. He's also the co-author of CODIS, a widely used Redis cache solution. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Hello, everyone.
Back in 2015, you were working at Wandoo Labs, and you released an open source project called CODIS. What sort of company was Wandoo Labs?
Wandoo Labs is a fast-growing internet company in China, and it is like an app store for Android platform. And this is Wandoo Labs. I was working in the storage infrastructure team at the time.
What problem were you trying to solve?
You know, at the time, we used Redis a lot. It's more than like 99% of online read workload is served by Redis. We used Redis as the front end of our database. So at the time, I think the amount of data is around 2 terabytes totally in Redis. I still remember, but Redis doesn't have a cluster mode back then. You know, I think it is a 2.3 or 2.4 version, I think. So of course you cannot fit this amount of data into the single node server, right? So this sharding the Redis cluster to many nodes is the only way. Back then we only have open source tool for sharding Redis. It is called Twin Proxy, TWEM Proxy. It is open sourced by Twitter, I think. It is a static sharding tool. It is a middleware of Redis. At the time, our business, our data is growing so fast. So resharding and rebalance the data in Redis is super painful for us. So it is the problem we are trying to solve. And that's why we want to create the CODIS, or we want to create a new Redis middleware. So to the application side, you can just use it like Redis. But under the hood, CODIS will automatically handle the data sharding, handle the data rebalance, data placement, and totally transparent to the application layer. And I think we came up with a very clever idea to keep the strong consistency and 100% availability while rebalancing the data in CODIS. That will save a lot of time and manpower on Redis at that time.
You built this, and you're doing sharding on your DB, assumably, and then sharding on the caching layer in front of your database. You decided to release and open source this work. What made you decide to open source your work?
CODIS at the time, I think it's 2013, I think, 13 or 14. And it is written in Go, Golang. And the code is very popular, widely used in my company at the time. And there are not many open source projects in Go community at that time. And we think that the code of CODIS is very elegant. At that time, we don't have a Redis cluster. And the problem CODIS is trying to solve is a general problem to the industry. So that means open source was a natural choice for us, and we didn't think too much of it. And we want to have more engineers to solve the scalability problem for Redis. And secondly, I really like Go programming language. I hope more people can use Go. And CODIS is a good example if you want to copy some code from. If you want to build your middleware and distributed system, you can borrow some code from CODIS. And we can prove that we can get the performance and the engineering productivity at the same time. So that's why we open source it. We want to show off how beautiful the code is.
Is this what sparked your interest in open source databases overall?
Yeah, actually, that is the beginning of TiDB and the TiKV.
In 2012 to 2013, Google released the Spanner and F1 papers. Did they have an influence on you or what you were creating?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of Google, and I think I have read most of the paper published by Google in the distributed system industry. So yeah, I still remember the first time I read the Spanner paper. I think the Spanner paper published first and came up with the F1 paper. I would say the TidyB project and TigerBee project is at the very beginning inspired by these two papers. I think this is the future of database.
Not long after releasing CODIS, you left Wandoo and created PingCap, where you released TyKV and TyDB. Which came first, the company or the projects?
Yeah. After the success of CODIS, I would say we were a little bit overconfident, right? So I just said that I was working on the storage infrastructure team at that time in Wandoo Labs. Behind the CODIS cluster, it is a huge sharded MySQL cluster. It has the same problem compared to the cache layer. The scale out MySQL cluster and resharding the MySQL is also really painful. So that means you have to give up the features of relational database, like transaction, like complex queries. You know, at the time, like CODIS, we want to build a new distributed database to replace the sharding MySQL cluster. But we have this idea in Wandoo Labs, and we talked to our boss, say, hey, we want to build a new database. But you know, it's a very ambitious project, even to the big internet company. And so that means a lot of investment. So our boss wasn't supporting us to do this because it is, you know, like a moonshot, but we just app store for Android platform. But we think we can build it. And the database, it is also the common pain point in the industry. So that means a big potential market, even though our boss wasn't supporting us, but we have a great reputation because of CODIS in the open source community in China. So it was not very hard for us to get some seed money from the venture capital funds. So we just decided to quit our job and full-time to create a startup to solve this problem. That's the beginning of the company and project.
What is the origin of the name PingCap? I noticed that the CAP are all capitalized. Is that a reference to the CAP theorem?
Yeah, it's a CAP theorem, yeah. And you know, TidyB is a CP system, consistency and partition tolerance, CP. But still with a very high availability, just like Spanner. I think in a sense, we are close to breaking the CAP theorem. So we use ping. Ping is the command, network command implies the connectivity. So this name means we want to link C and A and P. Yeah, it is a good view and it's a very geeky name. According to this, we can see this company is built by some engineers and it is a distributed system company. Yeah, that's why we use this name.
You've created two databases, TyKV and TyDB. What order should people think about these technologies? Do they build on each other or are they separate databases?
Actually, the TIDB here, the repo PingCap/TIDB, they work together. And the TIDB projects, the TyDB in this context, not the whole TyDB platform or TyDB project, is the stateless SQL layer built on top of TyKV. And the TyDB SQL layer exposes a stateless MySQL compatible endpoint to the application layer and translates the SQL statement, SQL statement, into the key value operations and send it to TyKV. So the data is actually stored within TyKV. And TyKV is a transactional key value distributed database, just like the relationship between Spanner and F1. So the TyDB is the F1 part. The TyKV is the Spanner part, but with a key value interface.
If TyDB is the SQL querying layer on top of TyKV, did you create them simultaneously or did you start with one and then later realize that the other would make a great addition to it?
I think it's a long story. We just started from the SQL layer first because we think it is closer to the application layer. At that time, we used HBase. You know, still remember HBase as the storage part of the SQL layer. So it is TyDB on top of HBase. we make HBase look like a MySQL cluster. But the performance is really terrible, you know? I think the big selling point of TidyDB is the transactions part, right? Just like Spanner have the ACID transaction, cross-row transaction. But, you know, based on HBase means that we have to implement another distributed transaction layer on top of HBase, which makes the performance even worse. So we decided to build our own distributed storage engine besides Hadoop. So that's the origin of TidyKV. And the beginning is the SQL layer, and then we found we have to build a high-performance key-value NoSQL database, and then we have TidyKV. I think it is 2015. At the beginning, we built SQL, and 2016 or 17, we started to build TidyKV.
If you put these two products together, how do you distinguish them from traditional databases people may be used to, like MySQL or Postgres?
The difference of MySQL and Postgres, you can consider TidyDB's super, super huge MySQL, and you don't need to worry about scalability, just like Spanner. From the application developer's perspective, you can still use your JDBC MySQL driver to connect to TidyDB, so you don't need to worry about the scalability, but at the same time, you can still keep the good features from traditional database like transaction, like complex join. You can use a single node database, but you have the good feature of the scale out, something like that.
Do you have any plans to merge these two projects, since it sounds like they are often used together?
Actually, the idea and the philosophy behind the whole TidyDB platform is highly layered. Just like Spanner and F1, they separated the computing and the storage. We think we should separate it, yeah, because it's a totally different project. And you know, we use different programming language for that. So it is, I would say, we will not merge them together because, you know, I'm a big fan of the Unix philosophy and do one thing, do things well.
You mentioned that you use different languages for each product. If I recall correctly, TidyKV is written in Rust while TidyDB is written in Go. Why did you choose different languages for each of these projects?
I really love Go. Before PingHap, I basically use Go to build everything if possible. So Go have a very simple syntax and grammar, which means very good engineering productivity. Although Go has a more CPU overhead compared to Rust or C++. And before PingHap, I haven't used Rust a lot, but it is really early, like 2016, and the Rust community is not very big. And I really like Go, but at the time, Go have a great big problem on GC performance. But right now, in recent version of Go, they have greatly improved the GC performance, so GC is not a problem in most cases. So we choose Go to build a SQL layer, even though we have the CPU overhead, but I think it's acceptable. But the problem with Go is the scheduler. If you have many Go routines, Go routines scheduling policy is invisible to developers, which is not very friendly in some performance critical scenarios, like building the storage engine. So we choose Rust to build a storage layer, like C++. It is closer to the bare metal, full control of the hardware with zero overhead. Even better compared to C++, you know, Rust have a very strict syntax to prevent the memory leaks and unsafe pointer reference at compile time. So we can have zero overhead. And compared to Go, Rust has a modern type system and modern syntax. But this comes with a cost of much steeper learning curve compared to Go. The TidyKV team is not very huge, but they are very the sharp engineers. And even though from the contributor level, TidyKV compares to TidyDB, the SQL layer, they have a smaller developer community, but we think it is because of the learning curve of Rust.
If you were to restart one of these projects today, Would you still write them in the same two languages you chose, or because of some of the garbage collection changes that have happened, as well as other improvements, would you pick a different language for one or both of these projects?
Well, from the technical point of view, I think I have already made the right choice. I don't want to change, but from the community perspective, probably I will use Go. That will give the TypeKV a larger developer community, I guess. And in the future, the performance for Go is the scheduler performance, the scheduler control is maybe no longer a problem. But I really love Go. They have a very good learning curve for the community and developer.
And they have a really cute icon. Some things you just have to go with your gut on. Speaking of which, you embraced Kubernetes pretty early on with your project. Why did you choose to build on Kubernetes?
Well, I just mentioned that I am a big fan of Google's infrastructure. Yeah, I like a lot of systems published by Google, you know, Spanner, F1, Megastore, Omega, Borg. And I think one of the hardest things for building the distributed system is not only the implementation. It is also with the hardest thing is the deployment, orchestration. I really think most people in the past, before Kubernetes, have underestimated the complexity of operating and maintaining the huge distributed systems. Engineers tend to focus on the algorithm and the code and how to implement it. But in the real world, we are talking about the cluster with hundreds or thousands of nodes and the complexity in operation, like how to do the failover, how to rolling upgrade. It is something we have to face every day. So one of the biggest contributions of Kubernetes is to simplify the development of a lot of automated maintenance logic for the infrastructure software. Yes, I'm talking about the operator and the CRD. So instead of a lot of fragile shell scripts, the infrastructure software can put the deployment and the maintenance logic into operator. So the users of this software do not need to understand a lot of the operational details. So just like you use APT package management to install, update your software on Linux, and you are all set. And second, I used to envy Google because of Borg. You know, Borg is very elegant and abstract the data center into the operating system, right? And it hides the complexity of the physical nodes for application. So what you can see is a well-defined resource and the APIs. I think it is very similar to something happened with a standalone operating system like Linux. Just like we use POSIX API, syscalls, and turn the bare metal hardware into some standard resource. So just like we program with POSIX C API provided by Linux, maybe in the future, let's say we assume that our system is running on Kubernetes, why we cannot rely on the resources and standard API provided by Kubernetes as part of our distributed application? So for example, if today I develop a cloud native database, I can use persistent volume as my storage and place my some code persistent data on using such API. And I can use local volume, local storage API to place some hot data for performance because sometimes the local PV is served by the SSD. And you don't need to care how to get and how to maintain this kind of resource. It is Kubernetes' job. So that will greatly reduce the complexity of building such new kind of distributed system. I think this is the future of distributed system. So at the very beginning of TidyV, we want to build a large-scale distributed system. We think we should find a great, good foundation for that and prepare for the future. So I think Kubernetes is a very natural choice.
For many years, there was debate about if running databases in Kubernetes was a good idea. You've clearly proven that you can. What were some of the biggest technical challenges in getting a distributed database running on top of Kubernetes?
It is a very sad story. For me, the hardest part is we used Kubernetes from very early versions like 1.23 or 1.4. Database is not like normal stateless application. We have to leverage the performance of local disk, especially the SSD. So we cannot directly use the network storage like persistent volume. We are not Google. We don't have Colossus because of the performance and the latency. So at the time, I still remember at the beginning, we use TPR, the third-party resource API, and customized controller to implement the local disk management controller to manage the local storage. So that's exactly what local PV API and local PV provisioner do today. So that means after Kubernetes 1.7 was released, we basically rewrote our operator using CRD to replace all the TPR. And after 1.10, I think Kubernetes released the local PV API. So we dropped out all our local disk management module and embraced the new API.
Always the risk of running something early on.
Yes. That's the sad story I mentioned.
As you've continued to work in this area, are there any improvements that you would like to see in Kubernetes?
Well, yes. I always want Kubernetes to have a better support for cross-data center, cross-region development, and multiple Kubernetes federation management. I think that would be nice. Because we are building something like Spanner, it is sometimes people want to deploy the database across multiple region, multiple data center. But I think Kubernetes today is not works well on the super huge cluster cross region.
You focused on things that are really high scale. What is the use case that you had in mind when you created TiDB? What separates it from other products already available that inspired you to go build this?
A scalable relational database with MySQL protocol. So that means this system can be the single source of truth for the entire enterprise. So in the old days, if we want to scale out a relational database, the only way is to, you know, sharding. But I just mentioned if you start using some sharding middleware on top of your database, that means you have to give up a lot of good features from the relational database. So if you can have a relational database interface, but with near unlimited scalability, that means that we reduce the complexity of building the cloud native application or microservice architecture, even for some, you know, any legacy application which relies on MySQL and meets the scalability issue. TiDB would provide an alternative solution with a very low migration cost. So I think even for Google, before F1 and Spanner, I think Google is using a huge MySQL sharding cluster for their Google Ads. So according to the paper published by F1, Google said, hey, we want to build a new database to replace the MySQL sharding cluster in Google Ads. So I think that's the same use case we want TiDB to help people.
Stepping back, you decided to submit TiKV, but not TiDB, to the CNCF. What made you decide not to donate TiDB?
You know, after releasing the first version of TiKV, and we found that the scalable transactional key value API is very basic storage primitive for building different kinds of systems. SQL is not a very basic semantic for building different kinds of systems, but key value API is very basic. And we found that, for example, imagine that if you want to build a new distributed file system, just like, hey, I want to build a Colossus. But the problem you may have is how to build a scalable metadata storage. Like in Hadoop, in HDFS, the name node is a single node. It is not, that cannot scalable. So if you have a storage system with very simple API, but still have some features like cross-row transaction, that will really reduce the complexity for building the large distributed system. Another great example is sometimes if you have a super huge Kubernetes cluster, sometimes etcd will be the bottleneck. That's why we want to donate PyKV.
Are you hoping to replace etcd at some point?
Etcd works well on, you know, thousands of nodes, a level cluster. But I think what I mentioned is some friend of mine in China, they have super huge Kubernetes cluster. But, you know, etcd is only a single, works well on a small cluster, but it is not scalable. Right, all the data is stored in within one node. So that's why some people are very interested in using PyKV as the storage part of etcd. So they replace the local storage with PyKV for etcd, and that etcd serves the super huge Kubernetes cluster. PyKV is like the building block. So we don't want to donate the whole product, like, oh, hey, we are promoting our product using CNCF as a marketing team. No, we just want to donate the building blocks, helping people to build other things.
It's like an open core model?
Something like that. Yeah, open core.
PyKV was accepted into the CNCF sandbox in August 2018. What happened at that point? What changed for you and for the project?
The one thing we really like about CNCF is CNCF doesn't involve too much within the project's decision. We have our own government's policy. We have our own operational rules for our community. And so CNCF to us, the significant support is the branding and the marketing and the logos in KubeCon and the different kinds of reports published by CNCF. People are really like to read. And especially outside China, we have a lot of adoptions in China, but outside of Asia, there's a high probability that our users know TiDB and the PyKV or PingCAP at the first time is from CNCF landscape. So we really appreciate that. But from the technical side, the CNCF doesn't involve too much, which we really appreciate that.
When you put it into the CNCF, did that change the adoption as people became aware of it outside the greater China region? What has that meant for contributions to the project?
I think for the open source software, adoption is everything. If you have more users, you have more adoption, means you can have more potential contributors. And I just mentioned that outside China, I think most of the adoption is driven by CNCF. So they build a great branding to us, and I think CNCF have a lot on driving adoption and build trust to the open source project. That's the contribution of the CNCF, but not only the code.
Not long after you were accepted into the sandbox, you closed a $50 million funding round. These two things must have been happening simultaneously. What did your venture backers think about the CNCF and you donating your code to open source?
I think at that time in Asia, especially in China, there are not too many open source projects working very well with the Western world like CNCF, but the PyKV project and PingCAP is a great example, proof that the project started in China or started outside Silicon Valley can work well with the global open source community. So our VCs think that, hey, this company is a global company. They work very closely to the global open source community. And yeah, so I think it is good news for them. Yeah. But actually, from my point of view, I didn't care too much about how VCs think about. We just want to do that.
I also wanted to say congratulations on your recent graduation of PyKV in the CNCF.
Thank you.
In July of this year, the CNCF accepted PingCAP's second project into the CNCF. That project is Chaos Mesh. This is something different from the last two open source database related technologies that you've done. What was your involvement in this project?
Chaos Mesh is we built it since the beginning of PingCAP. At the very beginning of PingCAP and TiDB, we are building the testing framework. You know, we are building a database. Distributed database is very complicated. It is a huge, ambitious project. So how to make sure your code is correct or how to reproduce the bugs effectively. So at the beginning, we used some technologies like fault injection. At that time, we don't even have a word called chaos engineering. That's something that by Netflix, like I think it's 2018. But even before that, we are invested a lot for the injection and the simulation test. That's the beginning of Chaos Mesh. And the Chaos Mesh, it is independent tools, works with Kubernetes. So that means you can use Chaos Mesh to mess up your Kubernetes environment for your application running on Kubernetes. These two, before we donate to CNCF, we widely use it internally. And it helps us to find a lot of bugs and find a lot of issues of TidyV. And we think it is a great tool. And it can not only work well with TidyV, and it will be very helpful if you want to build some microservice architecture. Imagine that if you have hundreds of microservices running on your Kubernetes cluster, you may worry about if some of the service crash, if that may cause the whole cluster or the whole service down. So Chaos Mesh is a tool that intentionally to do some fault injection to the cluster, and you can see if the system is stable and the failover is work just like you want it to work. And on the other hand, Chaos Mesh uses a lot of technology. It is very cloud native. We use Sidecar. We use some CRD to define the Chaos. So it is very easy to use. Because before Chaos Mesh, we use a lot of customized shell scripts. So it is not very stable and it is very hard to use. So that's the reason we build Chaos Mesh.
It's clear that you're a big fan and user of open source technology. Are there any projects out there that are on your radar and that you think are really interesting that people should know about?
Besides distributed system and the database, I really interested in programming language technology, especially the WASM, WASM. I think the WASM will be the next JVM. Recently, there is a very promising project called WASMER, WASMER, which is browser independent standalone WASM runtime. It is very interesting. So people can check it out. Yeah, I really like this project.
Finally, I know you used to be a fan of metal music. If there was one song that you had to listen to for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Well, I used to be a metal fan, but nowadays I will choose one song from Pink Floyd, but it is not metal.
Craig would be very happy. What song?
Dark Side of the Moon, the whole album. I think it's one song.
Ed, it's been great having you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can find Ed Hong on Twitter at DXHUANG.
Yeah, or you can just query on the search box, add PinkCap TidyV, and I will pop up.
Good taste in music there, Ed. Dark Side of the Moon should definitely be thought of as a single track, or at least two sides, but you have to listen to them consecutively.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you enjoyed this show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod, or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you will find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe. Until next time, take care.
Catch you next week.